and dismissal of one more forgettable irrelevance in the day of a file clerk. Out of the country. Why? For whom? What the hell's so different about this case? Ryan knew that it had many differences. He wondered if he'd ever have them all figured out. That's what they did to her, Kelly told them. It was the first time he'd actually said it all out loud, and in recounting the details of the pathology report, it was as though he were listening to the voice of another person. Because of her background, the cops never really assigned much of a priority to the case. I got two more girls out. One they killed. The other one, well, he waved at the newspaper. Why did you just turn her loose? Was I supposed to murder her, Mr. Ritter? That's what they were planning to do, Kelly said, still looking down. She was more or less sober when I let her go. I didn't have the time to do anything else. I miscalculated. How many? 12, sir, he answered, knowing that Ritter wanted the total number of kills. Good Lord, Ritter observed. He actually wanted to smile. There was talk, actually, of getting CIA involved in anti-drug operations. He opposed that policy. It wasn't important enough to divert the time of people who should be protecting their country against genuine national security threats. But he couldn't smile. This was far too serious for that. The article says 20 kilograms of the stuff. Is that true? Probably, Kelly shrugged. I didn't weigh it. There's one other thing. I think I know how the drugs come in. The bags smell like embalming fluid. It's Asian heroin. Yes? Ritter asked. Don't you see? Asian stuff. Embalming fluid. Comes in somewhere on the East Coast. Isn't it obvious? They're using the bodies of our KIAs to bring the fucking stuff in. All this and analytical ability, too? Ritter's phone rang. It was the intercom line. I said no calls, the field spook growled. It's Bill, sir. He says it's important. The timing was just perfect, the captain thought. The prisoners were brought out in the darkness. There was no electricity, again, and the only illumination came from battery-powered flashlights and a few torches that his senior sergeant had cobbled together. Every prisoner had his feet hobbled. In each case, the hands and elbows were bound behind their backs. They all walked slightly bent forward. It wasn't just to control them. Humiliation was important, too. And every man had in close attendance a conscript to chivy him along, right to the center of the compound. His men were entitled to this, the captain thought. They'd trained hard, were about to begin their long march south to complete the business of liberating and reuniting their country. The Americans were disoriented, clearly frightened at this break in their daily routine. Things had gone easy for them in the past week. Perhaps his earlier assembly of the group had been a mistake. It might have fostered some semblance of solidarity among them, but the object lesson to his troops was more than worth that. His men would soon be killing Americans in larger groups than this, the captain was sure. But they had to start somewhere. He shouted a command. As one man, the 20 selected soldiers took their rifles and butt-stroked their individual charges in the abdomen. One American managed to remain standing after the first blow, but not after the second. Zacharias was surprised. It was the first direct attack on his person since Kolya had stopped that one months before. The impact drove the air from him. His back already hurt from the lingering effect of his ejection and the deliberately awkward way they'd made him walk, and the impact of the steel butt plate of the AK-47 had taken control of his weakened and abused body away from him at once. He fell to his side, his body touching that of another prisoner, trying to draw his legs in and cover up. Then the kick started. He couldn't even protect his face with his arms bound painfully behind him, and his eyes saw the face of the enemy. Just a boy, maybe 17, almost girlish in appearance, and the look on his face was that of a doll, the same empty eyes, the same absence of expression. No fury, not even baring his teeth, just kicking him as a child might kick at a ball, because it was something to do. He couldn't hate the boy, but he could despise him for his cruelty, and even after the first kick broke his nose, he kept watching. Robin Zacharias had seen the depths of despair, had faced the fact that he'd broken on the inside and given up things that he knew. But he'd also had the time to understand it. He wasn't a coward any more than he was a hero, Robin told himself through the pain. Just a man. He'd bear the pain as the physical penalty for his earlier mistake, and he would continue to ask his God for strength. Colonel Zacharias kept his now blackened eyes on the face of the child tormenting him. I will survive this. I've survived worse, and even if I die, I'm still a better man than you will ever be, his face told the diminutive soldier. I've survived loneliness, and that's worse than this, kid. He didn't pray for deliverance now. It had come from within, after all, and if death came, then he could face it as he had faced his weakness and his failings. Another shouted command from their officer, and they backed off. In Robin's case, there was one last, final kick. He was bleeding, one eye almost shut, and his chest was racked with pain and coughs. But he was still alive, still an American, and he had survived one more trial. He looked over at the captain commanding the detail. There was fury in his face, unlike that of the soldier who'd taken a few steps back. Robin wondered why. "Stand them up!" the captain screamed. Two of the Americans were unconscious, it turned out, and required two men each to lift them. It was the best he could do for his men. Better to kill them, but the order in his pocket prohibited that, and his army didn't tolerate the violation of orders. Robin was now looking in the eyes of the boy who'd attacked him. Close, not 6 inches away. There was no emotion there, but he kept staring, and there was no emotion in his own eyes either. It was a small and very private test of wills. Not a word was spoken, though both men were breathing irregularly, one from exertion, the other from pain. Care to try it again someday? Man to man. Think you can hack that, Sonny? Do you feel shame for what you did? Was it worth it? Are you more of a man now, kid? I don't think so. And you might cover it up as best you can, but we both know who won this round, don't we? The soldier stepped to Robin's side, his eyes having revealed nothing. But the grip on the American's arm was very tight, the better to keep him under control, and Robin took that as his victory. The kid was still afraid of him, despite everything. He was one of those who roamed the sky, hated perhaps, but feared too. Abuse was the weapon of the coward, after all, and those who applied it knew the fact as well as those who had to accept it. Zacharias almost stumbled. His posture made it hard to look up, and he didn't see the truck until he was only a few feet away. It was a beat-up Russian vehicle, with fence wire over the top, both to prevent escape and to let people see the cargo. They were going somewhere. Robin had no real idea where he was and could hardly speculate on where he might go. Nothing could be worse than this place had been. And yet he'd survived it somehow, Robin told himself as the truck rumbled away. The camp faded into the darkness, and with it the worst trial of his life. The colonel bowed his head and whispered a prayer of thanksgiving. And then, for the first time in months, a prayer for deliverance, whatever form it might take. That was your doing, Mr. Clark, Ritter said after a long, deliberate look at the phone he'd just replaced. I didn't exactly plan it that way, sir. No, you didn't, but instead of killing that Russian officer, you brought him back. Ritter looked over at Admiral Greer. Kelly didn't see the nod that announced the change in his life. I wish Kaz could have known.
So, what do they know?
They have Xantha alive in Somerset County Jail. How much does she know? Charon asked. Tony Piaggi was here, too. It was the first time the two had met. They were using the about-to-be-activated lab in East Baltimore. It would be safe for Charon to come here just one time, the narcotics officer thought.
This is trouble, Piaggi observed. It seemed facile to the others until he went on. But we can handle it. First order of business, though, is to worry about making our delivery to my friends. We've lost 20 keys, man, Tucker pointed out bleakly. He knew fear now. It was clear that there was something out there worthy of his fear. You have more? Yeah, I have 10 at my place. You keep it at home? Piaggi asked. Jesus, Henry. The bitch doesn't know where I live. She knows your name, Henry. We can do a lot with just a name, Charon told him. Why the hell do you think I've kept my people away from your people? We've got to rebuild the whole organization, Piaggi said calmly. We can do that, okay? We have to move, but moving's easy. Henry, your stuff comes in somewhere else, right? You move it into here, and we move it out of here. So moving your operation is not a big deal. I lose my local... Fuck local, Henry. I'm going to take over distribution for the whole East Coast. Will you think, for Christ's sake? You lose maybe 25% of what you figured you were going to take in. We can make that up in 2 weeks. Stop thinking small time. Then it's a matter of covering your tracks, Charon went on, interested by Piaggi's vision of the future. Xantha is just one person, an addict. When they picked her up, she was wasted on pills. Not much of a witness unless they have something else to use. And if you move to another area, you ought to be okay. The other ones have to go. Fast, Piaggi urged. With Bert gone, I'm out of muscle. I can get some people, I know. No way, Henry. You want to bring new people in now? Let me call Philly. We have 2 people on retainer, remember? Piaggi got a nod, settling that issue. Next, we have to keep my friends happy. We need 20 keys worth of stuff, processed and ready to go, and we need it right fast. I only have 10, Tucker noted. I know where there's some more, and so do you. Isn't that right, Lieutenant Charon? That question shook the cop badly enough that he forgot to tell them something else that concerned him. Chapter 36 Dangerous Drugs. It was a time for introspection. He'd never done anything like this before at the behest of others, except for Vietnam, which was a different set of circumstances altogether. It had required a trip back to Baltimore, which was now as dangerous a thing as any he'd ever done. He had a new set of ID, but they were for a man known to be dead, if anyone took the time to check them out. He remembered almost fondly the time when the city had been divided into 2 zones, one relatively small and dangerous, and the other far larger and safe. That was changed. Now it was all dangerous. The police had his name. They might soon have his face, which would mean that every police car, there seemed an awful lot of them now, would have people in it who might spot him just like that. Worse still, he couldn't defend himself against them. He could not allow himself to kill a police officer. And now this. Things had become very confused today. Not even 24 hours earlier he'd seen his ultimate target, but now he wondered if it would ever be finished. Maybe it would have been better if he had never begun, just accepted Pam's death and gone on, waiting patiently for the police to break the case. But no, they would never have broken it. Would never have devoted the time and manpower to the death of a whore. Kelly's hands squeezed the wheel, and her murder would never have been truly avenged. Could I have lived the rest of my life with that? He remembered high school English classes, as he drove south, now on the Baltimore-Washington Parkway. Aristotle's Rules of Tragedy. The hero had to have a tragic flaw, had to drive himself to his fate. Kelly's flaw. He loved too much, cared too much, invested too much in the things and the people who touched his life. He could not turn away. Though it might save his life, to turn away would inevitably poison it. And so he had to take his chances and see things through. He hoped Ritter understood it, understood why he was doing what he had been asked to do. He simply could not turn away. Not from Pam. Not from the men of Boxwood Green. He shook his head, but he wished they'd asked someone else. The parkway became a city street, New York Avenue. The sun was long since down. Fall was approaching,
the change of seasons from the moist heat of mid-Atlantic summer. Football season would soon begin, and baseball end, and the turning of the years went on. Peter was right, Hicks thought. He had to stay in. His father was taking his own step into the system, after a fashion, becoming the most important of political creatures, a fundraiser and campaign coordinator. The president would be re-elected, and Hicks would accumulate his own power. Then he could really influence events. Blowing the whistle on that raid was the best thing he had ever done. Yeah, it was all coming together, he thought, lighting up his third joint of the night. He heard the phone ring. "How's it going?" It was Peter. "Okay, man, how's with you?" "Got a few minutes. I want to go over something with you." Henderson nearly swore to himself. He could tell Wally was stoned again. "Half an hour? See you then." Not a minute later, there was a knock on the door. Hicks stubbed out his smoke and went to answer it. Too soon for Peter. Could it be a cop? Fortunately, it wasn't. "You're Walter Hicks?" "Yeah, who are you?" The man was about his age, if somewhat less polished-looking. "John Clark." He looked nervously up and down the corridor. "I need to talk to you for a few minutes, if that's okay." "What about?" "Boxwood Green." "What do you mean?" "There's some things you need to know," Clark told him. He was working for the agency now, so Clark was his name. It made it easier somehow. "Come on in. I only have a few minutes, though. That's all I need. I don't want to stay too long." Clark accepted the waved invitation to enter and immediately smelled the acrid odor of burning rope. Hicks waved him to a chair opposite his. "Can I get you anything?" "No, thanks, I'm fine," he answered, careful where he put his hands. "I was there." "What do you mean?" "I was at Sender Green just last week." "You were on the team?" Hicks asked, intensely curious and not seeing the danger that had walked into his apartment. "That's right. I'm the guy who brought the Russian out," his visitor said calmly. "You kidnapped a Soviet citizen? Why the fuck did you do that?" "Why I did it is not important now, Mr. Hicks. One of the documents I took off his body is. It was an order to make preparations to kill all of our POWs." "That's too bad," Hicks said with a perfunctory shake of the head. "Oh, your dog died? That's too bad." "Doesn't that mean anything to you?" Clark asked. "Yes, it does, but people take chances." "Wait a minute." Hicks's eyes went blank for a moment, and Kelly could see that he was trying to identify something he'd missed. "I thought we had the camp commander, too, didn't we?" "No, I killed him myself." "That bit of information was given to your boss so that we could identify the name of the guy who leaked the mission." Clark leaned forward. "That was you, Mr. Hicks." "I was there. We had it wired. Those prisoners ought to be with their families right now, all 20 of them." Hicks brushed it aside. "I didn't want them to die. Look, like I said, people take chances. Don't you understand? It just wasn't worth it. So what are you going to do, arrest me? For what? You think I'm dumb? That was a black operation. You can't reveal it, or you run the risk of fucking up the talks, and the White House will never let you do that." "That's correct. I'm here to kill you." "What?" Hicks almost laughed. "You betrayed your country. You betrayed 20 men. Look, that was a matter of conscience." "So's this, Mr. Hicks." Clark reached into his pocket and pulled out a plastic bag. In it were drugs he'd taken off the body of his old friend Archie, and a spoon, and a glass hypodermic needle. He tossed the bag into his lap. "I won't do it." "Fair enough." From behind his back came his K-bar knife. "I've done people this way, too. There are 20 men over there who ought to be home. You've stolen their life from them. Your choice, Mr. Hicks." His face was very pale now, his eyes wide. "Come on, you wouldn't really... The camp commander was an enemy of my country. So are you.
You've got 1 minute. Hicks looked at the knife that Clark was turning in his hand, and knew that he had no chance at all. He'd never seen eyes like those across the coffee table from him, but he knew what they held. Kelly thought about the previous week as he sat there, remembering sitting in the mud generated by falling rain, only a few hundred yards from 20 men who ought now to be free. It became slightly easier for him, though he hoped never to have to obey such orders again. Hicks looked around the room, hoping to see something that might change the moment. The clock on the mantel seemed to freeze as he considered what was happening. He'd faced the prospect of death in a theoretical way at Andover in 1962, and subsequently lived his life in accordance with the same theoretical picture. The world had been an equation for Walter Hicks, something to be managed and adjusted. He saw now, knowing it was too late, that he was merely one more variable in it, not the guy with the chalk looking at the blackboard. He considered jumping from the chair, but his visitor was already leaning forward, extending the knife a few inches, and his eyes fixed on the thin silvery line on the parkerized blade. It looked so sharp that he had trouble drawing breath. He looked at the clock again. The second hand had moved, after all. Peter Henderson took his time. It was a weekday night, and Washington went to bed early. All the bureaucrats and aides and special assistants, too, rose early and had to have their rest so that they'd be alert in the management of their country's affairs. It made for empty sidewalks in Georgetown, where the roots of trees heaved up the concrete slabs of sidewalk. He saw two elderly folk walking their little dog, but only one other, on Wally's block. Just a man about his age, 50 yards away, getting into a car whose lawnmower sound marked it as a Beetle, probably an older one. Damned ugly things lasted forever if you wanted them to. A few seconds later, he knocked on Wally's door. It wasn't fully closed. Wally was sloppy about some things. He'd never make it as a spy. Henderson pushed the door open, ready to reprove his friend, until he saw him there, sitting in the chair. Hicks had his left sleeve rolled up. His right hand had caught on his collar, as though to help himself breathe. But the real reason was on the inside of his left elbow. Peter didn't approach the body. For a moment, he didn't do anything. Then he knew he had to get out of there. He removed a handkerchief and wiped the doorknob, closed the door, and walked away, trying to keep his stomach under control. "Damn you, Wally," Henderson raged. "I needed you. And to die like this, from a drug overdose." The finality of death was as clear to him as it was unexpected. But there remained his beliefs, Henderson thought as he walked home. At least those hadn't died. He would see to that. The trip took all night. Every time the truck hit a bump, bones and muscles screamed their protest. Three of the men were hurt worse than he was, two of them unconscious on the floor, and there wasn't a thing he could do for them with his hands and legs bound up. Yet there was satisfaction of a sort. Every destroyed bridge they had to drive around was a victory for them. Someone was fighting back. Someone was hurting these bastards. A few men whispered things that the guard at the back of the truck didn't hear over the engine noise. Robin wondered where they were going. The cloudy sky denied him the reference of stars, but with dawn came an indication of where east was, and it was plain that they were heading northwest. Their true destination was too much to hope for, Robin told himself, but then he decided that hope really was something without limit. Kelly was relieved it was over. There was no satisfaction in the death of Walter Hicks. He'd been a traitor and coward, but there ought to have been a better way. He was glad that Hicks had decided to take his own life, for he wasn't at all sure that he could have killed him with a knife, or any other way. But Hicks had deserved his fate, of that one thing he had no doubts. But don't we all, Kelly thought. Kelly packed his clothing into the suitcase, which was large enough to contain it all, and carried it out to the rented car. And with that, his residence in the apartment ended. It was after midnight when he drove south again, into the center of the danger zone, ready to act one last time. Things had settled down for Chuck Monroe. He still responded to break-ins and all manner of other crimes, but the slaughter of pushers in his district had ended. Part of him thought it was too bad, and he admitted as much to other patrolmen over lunch, in his case the mercifully unnamed 3-in-the-morning meal. Monroe drove his radio car in his almost regular patrol pattern, still looking for things out of the ordinary. He noted that 2 new people had taken Juju's place. He'd have to learn their street names, maybe have an informant check them out. Maybe the narcs from downtown could start making a few things happen out here. Someone had, however briefly, Monroe admitted, heading west towards the edge of his patrol area. Whoever the hell it was. A street bum. That made him smile in the darkness. The informal name applied to the case seemed so appropriate. The Invisible Man. Amazing that the papers hadn't picked that one up. A dull night made for such thoughts. He was thankful for it. People had stayed up late to watch the Orioles sock it to the Yankees. He had learned that you could often track street crime by sports teams and their activities. The O's were in a pennant race and were looking to go all the way on the strength of Frank Robinson's bat and Brooks Robinson's glove. Even Hoods liked baseball, Monroe thought, perplexed by the incongruity, but accepting it for the fact it was. It made for a boring night, and he didn't mind. It gave him a chance to cruise and observe and learn, and to think. He knew all the regulars on the street now, and was now learning to spot what was different, to eyeball it as a seasoned cop could, to decide what to check out and what to let slide. In learning that, he would come to prevent some crimes, not merely respond to them. It was a skill that could not come too quickly, Monroe thought to himself. The very western border of his area was a north-south street. One side was his, the other that of another officer. He was about to turn onto it when he saw another street bum. Somehow the person looked familiar, though he was not the one Monroe had shaken down several weeks earlier. Tired of sitting in his car, and bored with not having had anything more than a single traffic citation tonight, he pulled over. "Yo, hold up there, sport." The figure kept moving, slowly, unevenly. Maybe a public drunkenness arrest in the making. More likely a street person whose brain was permanently impaired by long nights of guzzling the cheap stuff. Monroe slid his baton into the ring holder and walked quickly to catch up. It was only a 50-foot walk, but it was like the poor old bastard was deaf or something. He didn't even hear the click of his leather heels on the sidewalk. His hand came down on the bum's shoulder. "I said hold up now." Physical contact changed everything. This shoulder was firm and strong, and tense. Monroe simply wasn't ready for it. Too tired, too bored, too comfortable, too sure of what he'd seen. And though his brain immediately shouted, "The Invisible Man," his body was not ready for action. That wasn't true of the bum. Almost before his hand came down, he saw the world rotate wildly from low right to high left, showing him a sky, and then the sidewalk, and then the sky again. But this time his view of the stars was interrupted by a pistol. "Why couldn't you have just stayed in your fucking car?" the man asked angrily. "Who? Quiet!" The pistol against his forehead ensured that, almost. It was the surgical gloves that gave him away and forced the officer to speak. "Jesus." It was a respectful whisper. "You're him." "Yes, I am. Now what the hell do I do about you?" Kelly asked. "I ain't gonna beg." The man's name was Monroe, Kelly saw from the name tag. He didn't seem like the sort for begging. "You don't have to. Roll over, now." The policeman did so, with a little help. Kelly pulled the cuffs off his belt and secured them to both wrists. "Relax, Officer Monroe." "What do you mean?" The man kept his voice even, earning his captor's admiration. "I mean I'm not going to kill any cops." Kelly stood him up and started walking him back to the car. "This doesn't change anything, sport," Monroe told him, careful to keep his voice low. "Tell me about it. Where do you keep your keys?" "Right side pocket." "Thank you." Kelly took them as he put the officer in the back seat of the car. There was a screen there to keep arrested passengers from annoying the driver. He quickly started the patrol car and parked it in an alley. Your hands okay? Not too tight on the cuffs? Yeah, I'm just fucking fine back here. The cop was shaking now, mainly rage, Kelly figured. That was understandable. Settle down. I don't want you to get hurt. Now lock the car. Keys'll be in a sewer somewhere. Am I supposed to thank you or something? Monroe said. I didn't ask for that, did I? Kelly had an overwhelming urge to apologize for embarrassing the man. You made it easy for me. Next time be more careful, Officer Monroe. His own release of tension almost evoked a laugh as he walked away quickly to the rear. Thank God, he thought, heading west again, but not for everything. They're still rousting drunks. He'd hoped that they'd gotten bored with it in the past month. One more complication. Kelly kept to the shadows and alleys as much as possible. It was a storefront, just as Billy had told him and Bert had confirmed. An out-of-business store with vacant houses to the left and right. Such talkative people under the proper circumstances. Kelly looked at it from across the street. Despite the vacant ground level, there was a light on upstairs. The front door, he could see, was secured with a large brass lock. The back one, too, probably. Well, he could do this one the hard way. Or the other hard way. There was a clock ticking. Those cops had to have a regular reporting system. Even if not, sooner or later Monroe would be sent a call to get somebody's kitten out of a tree. And real quick his sergeant would start wondering where the hell he was. And then the cops would be all over the place looking for a missing man. They'd look carefully and hard. That was a possibility Kelly didn't want to contemplate, and one which waiting would not improve. He crossed the street briskly, for the first time breaking his cover in public, such as it was, weighing risks and finding the balance evenly set on madness. But then the whole enterprise had been mad from the start, hadn't it? First he did his best to check out the street level for people. Finding none, Kelly took the K-bar from his sheath and started attacking the caulking around the full-length glass pane in the old wooden door. Perhaps burglars just weren't patient, he thought, or maybe just dumb. Or smarter than he was being at the moment, Kelly told himself, using both hands to strip the caulking away. It took 6 endless minutes, all of it under a streetlight not 10 feet away, before he was able to lower the glass, cutting himself twice in the process. Kelly swore quietly, looking at the deep cut on his left hand. Then he stepped sideways through the opening and headed for the back of the building. Some mom-and-pop store, he thought. Abandoned or something. Probably because the neighborhood itself was dying. Well, it could have been worse. The floor was dusty but uncluttered. There were stairs in the back. Kelly could hear noise upstairs, and he went up, his .45 leading the way. "It's been a nice party, honey, but it's over now," a male voice said. Kelly heard the rough humor in it, followed by a female whimper.
"Please, you don't mean you're..."
"Sorry, honey, but that's just the way things are," another voice said. "I'll do the front." Kelly eased down the corridor. Again the floor was unobstructed, just dirty. The wooden floor was old, but had been recent. It creaked. "What's that?" Kelly froze for the briefest moment, but there was neither time nor a place to hide, and he darted the last 15 feet, then dived in low and rolled to unmask his pistol. There were 2 men, both in their 20s, just shapes, really, as his mind filtered out the irrelevancies and concentrated on what mattered now: size, distance, movement. One was reaching for a gun as Kelly rolled, and even got his gun out of his belt and coming around before 2 rounds entered his chest and another his head. Kelly brought his weapon around even before the body fell.
"Jesus Christ, okay, okay!"
A small chrome revolver dropped to the floor. There was a loud scream from the front of the building, which Kelly ignored as he got back to his feet, his automatic locked on the second man as though connected by a steel rod.
"They're gonna kill us."
It was a surprisingly mousy voice, frightened but slow from whatever she was using. "How many?" Kelly snapped at her.
"Just these 2. They're going to..."
"I don't think so," Kelly told her, standing. "Which one are you?"
"Paula."
He was covering his target. "Where are Maria and Roberta?"
They're in the front room,
Paula told him, still too disoriented to wonder how he knew the names. The other man spoke for her.
Fessed up, pal, okay?
Let's talk, the man's eyes tried to say. Who are you?
There was just something about a 45 that made people talk, Kelly thought, not knowing what his eyes looked like behind the sights.
Frank Molinari.
An accent, and the realization that Kelly wasn't a policeman.
Where from, Frank?
You stay put, Kelly told Paula with a pointed left hand. He kept the gun level, eyes sweeping around, ears searching for a danger sound.
Philly. Hey, man, we can talk, okay?
He was shaking, eyes flickering down to the gun he'd just dropped, wondering what the hell was happening. Why was somebody from Philadelphia doing Henry's dirty work? Kelly's mind raced. Two of the men at the lab had sounded the same way. Tony Piaggi. Sure, the mob connection, and Philadelphia. Ever been to Pittsburgh, Frank? Somehow the question just popped out. Molinari took his best guess. It was not a good one.
How did you know that?
Who you working for?
Killed Doris and her father, right?
It was a job, man. Ever do a job? Kelly gave him the only possible answer, and there was another scream from the front as he brought the gun back in close to his chest. Time to think. The clock was still ticking. Kelly walked over and yanked Paula to her feet.
That hurts.
Come on, let's get your friends. Maria was wearing only panties and was too stoned to do any looking. Roberta was conscious and afraid. He didn't want to look at them, not now. He didn't have time. Kelly got them together and forced them down the stairs, then outside. None had shoes, and the combination of drugs and the grit and glass on the sidewalk made them walk in a crippled fashion, whimpering and crying on their way east. Kelly pushed at them, growled at them, making them move faster, fearing nothing more grave than a passing car, because that was enough to wreck everything he'd done. Speed was vital. And it took 10 minutes as endless as his race down the hill from Cinder Green, but the police car was still there where he'd left it. Kelly unlocked the front and told the women to get in. He'd lied about the keys.
What the fuck? Monroe objected.
Kelly handed the keys to Paula, who seemed the best able to drive. At least she was able to hold her head up. The other two huddled on the right side, careful to keep their legs away from the radio. Officer Monroe, these ladies will be driving you to your station. I have instructions for you. You ready to listen?
I got a choice, asshole.
You want to play power games, or do you want some good information? Kelly asked as reasonably as he could. Two pairs of sober eyes lingered in a long moment of contact. Monroe swallowed hard on his pride and nodded.
Go ahead.
Sergeant Tom Douglas is the man you want to talk to. Nobody else, just him. These ladies are in some really deep shit. They can help you break some major cases. Nobody but him. That's important, okay?
You fuck that up and we'll meet again, Kelly's eyes told him.
Monroe caught all the messages and nodded his head.
Yeah.
Paula, you drive. Don't stop for anything, no matter what he says. You got that? The girl nodded. She'd seen him kill two men. Get moving. She really was too intoxicated to drive, but it was the best he could do. The police car crept away, scraping a telephone pole halfway down the alley. Then it turned the corner and was gone. Kelly took a deep breath, turning back to where his own auto was. He hadn't saved Pam. He hadn't saved Doris. But he had saved these three, and Xantha, at a peril to his life that had at turns been both unintentional and necessary. It was almost enough. But not quite. The two-truck convoy had to take a route even more circuitous than planned, and they didn't arrive at the destination until afternoon. That was Hualo Prison. The name meant Place of Cooking Fires, and its reputation was well known to the Americans. When the trucks had pulled into the courtyard and the gates were secure, the men were let down. Again, each man was given an individual guard who took him inside. They were allowed a drink of water and nothing more before assignment to individual cells that were scattered around, and presently Robin Zacharias found his. It wasn't much of a change, really. He found a nice piece of floor and sat down, tired from the journey, resting his head against the wall.
It took several minutes before he heard the tapping. Shave and a haircut, 6 bits. Shave and a haircut, 6 bits. His eyes opened. He had to think. The POWs used a communications code as simple as it was old, a graphic alphabet. Tap, 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 tap. Pause. Tap, tap. 5-2, Robin thought. The novelty of the moment, fighting through fatigue. Letter W. Okay, I can do this. 2-3, 3-4, 4-2, 4-5. Tap, 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 tap. Robin broke that off for his reply. 4-2, 3-4, 1-2, 2-4, 3-3, 5-5, 1-1, 1-3. Tap, 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 tap. 1-1, 3-1, 5-2, 1-1, 3-1, 3-1. Al Wallace? Al? He's alive? Tap, 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 tap. How are you? He asked his friend of 15 years. Making it, came the reply. Then an addition for his fellow Utahan. 1-3-3-4-3-2. 1-5-1-3-3-4-3-2. 1-5-5-4-1-5. Come, come, ye saints. Robin gasped, not hearing the taps, hearing the choir, hearing the music, hearing what it meant. Tap, 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 tap. 1-1-3-1-3-1-2-4-4-3-5-2-1-5-3-1-3-1-1-1-3-1-3-1-2-4-4-3-5-2-1-5-3-1-3-1. Robin Zacharias closed his eyes and gave thanks to his God for the second time in a day and the second time in over a year. He'd been foolish, after all, to think that deliverance might not come. This seemed a strange place for it, and stranger circumstances. But there was a fellow Mormon in the next cell, and his body shuddered as his mind heard that most beloved of hymns, whose final line was not a lie at all, but an affirmation. All is well. All is well. Monroe didn't know why this girl, Paula, didn't listen to him. He tried reason. He tried a bellowed order, but she kept driving, albeit following his directions, creeping along the early morning streets at all of 10 miles per hour, and at that, staying in her lane only rarely and with difficulty. It took 40 minutes. She lost her way twice, mistaking right for left, and once stopped the car entirely when another of the women vomited out the window. Slowly Monroe came to realize what was happening. It was a combination of things that did it, but mainly that he had the time to dope it out. "What did he do?" Maria asked.
They were going to kill us, just like the others, but he shot them.
Jesus, Monroe thought. That cinched it. Paula?
Yes?
Did you ever know somebody named Pamela Madden? Her head went up and down slowly as she concentrated on the road once more. The station was in sight now.
Dear God, the policeman breathed.
Paula, turn right into the parking lot, okay? Pull around the back. That's a good girl. You can stop right here, okay? The car jerked to a halt and Paula started crying piteously. There was nothing for him to do but wait a minute or two until she got over the worst of it, and Monroe's fear was now for them, not himself. Okay now, I want you to let me out. She opened her door and then the rear one. The cop needed help getting to his feet, and she did it for him on instinct. The car keys, there's a handcuff key on it. Can you unlock me, miss? It took her 3 tries before his hands were free. Thank you.
This better be good, Tom Douglas growled. The phone cord came across his wife's face, waking her up, too.
Sergeant, this is Chuck Monroe, Western District. I have 3 witnesses to the Fountain murder. He paused. I think I have 2 more bodies for the Invisible Man, too. He told me I should only talk to you.
Huh?
The detective's face twisted in the darkness.
Who did?
The Invisible Man. You want to come down here, sir? It's a long one, Monroe said.
Don't talk to anybody else. Not anybody. You got that?
He told me that, too, sir.
What is it, honey? Beverly Douglas asked, as awake as her detective husband now.
It was 8 months now since the death of a sad, petite girl named Helen Waters. Then Pamela Madden. Then Doris Brown. He was going to get the bastards now, Douglas told himself. Incorrectly.
"What are you doing here?" Sandy asked the figure standing next to her car, the one he had fixed. "Saying goodbye for a while," Kelly told her quietly. "What do you mean?" "I'm going to have to go away. I don't know for how long."
"Where to?"
"I can't really say."
"Vietnam again?"
"Maybe. I'm not sure. Honest." It just wasn't the time for this, as though it ever was, Sandy thought. It was early, and she had to be at work at 6:30. And though she wasn't running late, there simply weren't the minutes she needed for what had to be said.
"Will you be back?"
"If you want, yes."
"I do, John."
"Thank you." "Sandy, I got 4 out," he told her.
4?
4 girls, like Pam and Doris. One's over on the Eastern Shore, the other 3 are here in town at a police station. Make sure somebody takes care of them, okay?"
"Yes."
"No matter what you hear, I'll be back. Please believe that."
"John!"
"No time, Sandy." "I'll be back," he promised her, walking away.
Neither Ryan nor Douglas wore a tie. Both sipped at coffee from styrofoam cups while the lab boys did their job again. 2 in the body, one of them was saying. 1 in the head. Always leaves the target dead. This is a professional job." "The real kind," Ryan breathed to his partner. It was a 45. It had to be. Nothing else made that kind of mess. And besides, there were 6 brass cartridge cases on the hardwood floor, each circled in chalk for the photographers. The 3 women were in a cell in Western District, with a uniformed officer in constant attendance. He and Douglas had spoken to them briefly, long enough to know that they had their witnesses against one Henry Tucker, murderer. Name, physical description, nothing else. But infinitely more than they'd had only hours before. They'd first checked their own files for the name, then the FBI's National Register of Felons, then the street. They'd check motor vehicle records for a license in that name. The procedure was entirely straightforward, and with a name they'd get him, maybe soon, maybe not. But then there was this other little matter before them. "Both of them from out of town?" Ryan asked. "Philadelphia. Francis Molinari and Albert Dandino," Douglas confirmed, reading the names off their driver's licenses. "How much you want to bet?"
"No bet, Tom."
He turned, holding up a photograph. "Monroe, this face look familiar?" The patrol officer took the small ID photo from Ryan's hand and looked at it in the poor light of the upstairs apartment. He shook his head.
"Not really, sir."
"What do you mean? You were face to face with the guy."
"Longer hair.
Smudges on his face.
Mainly when we were up close, I saw the front end of a Colt. Too fast. Too dark."
It was tricky and dangerous, which wasn't unusual. There were 4 automobiles parked out front, and he couldn't afford to make any noise. But it was the safest course of action as well, with those 4 cars parked in front. He was standing on the marginal space provided by a sill of a bricked-up window, reaching for the telephone cable. Kelly hoped nobody was using the phone as he clipped into the wires, quickly attaching leads of his own. With that done, he dropped down and started walking north along the back of the building, trailing out his own supply of commo wire, just letting it lie on the ground. He turned the corner, letting the spool dangle from his left hand like a lunch pail. Crossing the little used street, moving casually like a person who belonged there. Another 100 yards and he turned again, entering the deserted building and climbing to his perch. Once there, he returned to his rented car and got out the rest of what he needed, including his trusty whiskey flask, filled with tap water, and a supply of Snickers bars. Ready, he settled down to his task. The rifle wasn't properly sighted in. Mad as it seemed, the most sensible course of action was to use the building as his target. He shouldered the weapon in a sitting position and searched the wall for a likely spot. There, an off-color brick. Kelly controlled his breathing with the scope dialed to its highest magnification and squeezed gently. It was strange firing this rifle. The .22 rimfire is a small, inherently quiet round, and with the elaborate suppressor he'd constructed on it, for the first time in his life he heard the music note ping of the striker hitting the firing pin, along with the muted pop of the discharge. The novelty of it almost distracted Kelly from hearing the far louder swat of the impact of the round on the target. The bullet created a puff of dust, 2 inches left and 1 inch high of his point of aim. Kelly clicked in the adjustment on the Leupold scope and fired again. Perfect. Kelly worked the bolt and then fed 3 rounds into the magazine, dialing the scope back to low power.
"Did you hear something?" Piaggi asked tiredly. "What's that?"
Tucker looked up from his task. More than 12 hours now, doing the scut work that he'd thought to be behind him forever. Not even halfway done, despite the 2 soldiers that were down from Philadelphia. Tony didn't like it either.
"Like something falling," Tony said, shaking his head and getting back to it.
The only good thing that could be said about this was that it would earn him respect when he related the tale to his associates up and down the coast. A serious man, Anthony Piaggi. When everything went to shit, he'd done the work himself. He makes his deliveries and meets his obligations. You can depend on Tony. It was a rep worth earning, even if this was the price. It was a resolute thought that persisted for perhaps 30 seconds. Tony slid open another bag, noting the evil chemical smell on it, not quite recognizing it for what it was. The fine white powder went into the bowl. Next he dumped in the milk sugar. He mixed the 2 elements with spoons, stirring it slowly. He was sure there must be a machine for this operation, but it was probably too large, like what they used at commercial bakeries. Mainly his mind was protesting that this was work for little people. Hirelings. Still, he had to make that delivery, and there was no one else to help out.
"What did you say?" Henry asked tiredly.
"Forget it." Piaggi concentrated on his task. Where the hell were Albert and Frank? They were supposed to be here a couple hours ago. Thought they were special because they whacked people, like that stuff really mattered.
"Hey, Lieutenant."
The sergeant who ran the central evidence storage room was a former traffic officer whose 3-wheel bike had run afoul of a careless driver. That had cost him 1 leg and relegated him to administrative duty, which suited the sergeant, who had his desk and his donuts and his paper, in addition to clerkish duties that absorbed maybe 3 hours of real work per 8-hour shift. It was called retirement in place.
"How's the family, Harry?"
"Fine, thanks. What can I do for you?"
"I need to check the numbers on the drugs I brought in last week," Charon told him. "I think there might be a mix-up on the tags." "Anyway," he shrugged, "I have to check it out."
"Okay, just give me a minute and I'll..."
"Read your paper, Harry. I know where to go," Charon told him with a pat on the shoulder. Official policy was that nobody wandered around in this room without an official escort, but Charon was a lieutenant, and Harry was short 1 leg, and his prosthesis was giving him trouble, as it usually did.
"That was a nice shoot, Mark," the sergeant told his back.
What the hell, he thought. Mark whacked the guy who'd been carrying the stuff. Charon looked and listened for any other person who might be here, but there was none. They'd pay him big time for this. Talk about moving their operation, eh? Leave him out in the cold, back to chasing pushers. Well, not entirely a bad thing. He had a lot of money banked away, enough to keep his former wife happy and educate the 3 kids he'd given her, plus a little for him. He'd probably even get a promotion soon because of the work he'd done, taking down several drug distributors. There. The 10 kilos he had taken from Eddie Morello's car were in a labeled cardboard box, sitting on the 3rd shelf, right where they were supposed to be. He took the box down and looked to be sure. Each of the 10 1-kilo bags had to be opened, tested, and resealed. The lab technician who'd done it had just initialed the tags, and his initials were easy to fake. Charon reached into his shirt and pants, pulling out plastic bags of 4X sugar, which was of the same color and consistency as the heroin. Only his office would ever touch this evidence, and he could control that. In a month he'd send a memo recommending destruction of the evidence, since the case on it was closed. His captain would approve. He'd dump it down the drain with several other people watching, and the plastic bags would be burned, and nobody would ever know. It certainly seemed simple enough. Within 3 minutes, he was walking away from the evidence racks. Numbers check out? Yeah, Harry, thanks, Charon said, waving on the way out.
Somebody get the fucking phone, Piaggi growled. Who the hell would be calling here anyway?
It was one of the Philly guys who walked over, taking the time to light a cigarette.
Yeah?
The man turned.
Henry, it's for you.
What the hell? Tucker walked over.
Hi, Henry, Kelly said.
He'd wired a field phone into the building's telephone line, cutting it off from the outside world. He sat there, next to the canvas-covered instrument, having rung the other end just by turning the crank. It seemed rather primitive, but it was something familiar and comfortable to him, and it worked.
Who's this?
The name's Kelly. John Kelly, he told him.
So who's John Kelly?
4 of you killed Pam. You're the only one left, Henry, the voice said. I got the rest. Now it's your turn. Tucker turned and looked around the room as though he expected to find the voice there. Was this some kind of sick joke that they were playing on him?
How'd you get this number? Where are you?
Close enough, Henry, Kelly told him. You nice and comfy in there with your friends?
Look, I don't know who you are.
I told you who I am.
You're in there with Tony Piaggi.
I saw you at his restaurant the other night. How was your dinner, by the way? Mine was just great, the voice taunted. Tucker stood straight up, his hand tight on the phone.
So what the fuck are you gonna do, boy?
I ain't gonna kiss you on both cheeks, boy. I got Rick, and I got Billy, and I got Bert, and now I'm going to get you. Do me a favor, put Mr. Piaggi on the line, the voice suggested.
Tony, you better come here, Tucker said.
What is it, Henry?
Piaggi tripped on his chair, getting up.
So damn tired from all this. Those bastards in Philly better have the cash all ready. Henry handed him the phone.
Who's this?
Those two guys on the boat? The ones you gave to Henry?
I got 'em.
I got the other two this morning, too.
What the fuck is this?
You figure it out. The line went dead. Piaggi looked over at his partner, and since he couldn't get an answer from the phone, he'd get one from Tucker.
Henry, what the hell is this?
Okay, let's see what that stirred up. Kelly allowed himself a sip of water and a Snickers. He was on the third story of the building. Some sort of warehouse, he thought, massively constructed of reinforced concrete. A good place to be when the bomb went off. The tactical problem was an interesting one. He couldn't just burst inside. Even if he'd had a machine gun, he didn't. 4 against 1 was long odds, especially when you didn't know what was inside the door. Especially when stealth was something you couldn't count on as an ally. And so he'd try another approach. He'd never done anything like this before, but from his perch he could cover every door of the building. The windows in the back were bricked up. The only ways out were under his sight, and at just over 100 yards he hoped that they'd try it. Kelly shouldered the rifle, but kept his head up, sweeping left and right in an even, patient way.
"It's him," Henry said quietly so the others couldn't hear.
"Who?"
The guy who did all those pushers. The guy who got Billy and the rest. The guy who did the ship. It's him.
Well, who the fuck is him, Henry?
I don't know, goddammit.
The voice was higher now, and the other two heads looked up. Tucker got more control of himself.
He says he wants us to come out.
Oh, that's just great. What are we up against?
Wait a minute. Piaggi lifted the phone, but got no dial tone.
What the hell?
Kelly heard the buzz and lifted the handset.
Yeah, what is it?
Who the fuck are you?
It's Tony, right? Why did you have to kill Doris, Tony? She wasn't any danger to you. Now I have to do you, too.
I didn't...
You know what I mean, but thanks for bringing those two down here. I wanted to tie that loose end up, but I didn't expect to have the chance. They're in the morgue by now, I suppose.
Trying to scare me? The man demanded over the scratchy phone line. No, just trying to kill you, Kelly told him.
Fuck!